The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939. This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, the impeachment saga is finally over. The coronavirus continues to plague the markets, while economic news surprises on the upside. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Ari Wald from Oppenheimer sees the markets heading higher with the S&P hitting 3,600. You're going to want to hear the sectors he favors. Also later on, portfolio manager Greg Orrell will be joining us from the top-rated OCM Gold Fund as he explains the main drivers behind the rise in gold and gold shares. And finally, Chris Sheridan and Chris Poplava are here with another edition of Smart Macro. All that coming up later on in the program.
This week marked new record highs for the major U.S. indices before a slight pullback on Friday as fear spread surrounding the coronavirus. For the week as a whole, the Dow was up 3%, ending at 29,102, the S&P 500 advancing 3.2%, closing at 3,327, and the NASDAQ gained 4% to close on Friday at 9,520. 10-year Treasury yields are now just under 1.6%. West Texas crude, which has seen a pretty sharp decline for the start of this year, is now back just above $50. Gold, however, is currently holding steady around 7-year highs and ended the week a little over 0.25% at $1,574 per ounce. How have the U.S. indices fared year to date? Well, if we look at the numbers, the NASDAQ is actually up 6.1%, the S&P 500 up 3%, the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 2%, and the Russell 2000 is down 0.7% year to date. This week marked an excellent string of reports on the U.S. economy. U.S. economy adding 225,000 jobs in January. That was well above the 165,000 estimate by most economists. Briefing.com reporting that the key takeaway from this report is that employment conditions remain in that sweet spot of being encouraging on the hiring front and on the inflation front because earnings growth isn't accelerating sharply enough to provoke imminent rate hike concerns. Data was also positive for the manufacturing and services parts of the U.S. economy, increasing by more than expected. The ISM Manufacturing Index is now back above 50 at 50.9, reflecting an expanding manufacturing sector here in the U.S. for the first time in 6 months. If we take all these numbers together, the Atlanta Fed GDP now cast for the first quarter of 2020 stands at 2.7%. The New York Fed now cast, which was also updated just on Friday, is at 1.7% for the first quarter. So if you average those two together, the now cast models are projecting just a little over 2% for the first quarter in 2020. One of the things that led to a bit of a pullback on Friday was the China's National Health Commission confirming more than 31,000 cases of the coronavirus in the country with more than 630 deaths. As well, the disease continues to spread outside the country. In response, the People's Bank of China has now injected 1.7 trillion yuan, that's about $243 billion, of liquidity into the financial system to stem the impact as it's now starting to weigh on travel and their economic output, with estimates projecting anywhere from a 1 to 2% hit to their economy for the first quarter of this year, depending on how well they're able to contain the virus. That's your market wrap for this week. One of the greatest mistakes currently being made is the fact that there is way too much debt in the system. One of the most notable examples is China. This week we had a fascinating interview with the renowned investment strategist and financial historian Russell Napier. Here's a clip of what he had to say on China's debt to GDP levels.
Having constructed a quite detailed database, which for the first time really includes private sector debt going back about 20 years, they decided to effectively data mine the data set to see if there was anything in the data which could foretell financial crisis. And just to be precise, it would be a systemic banking crisis within 3 years. Interestingly, the debt to GDP levels were not the indicator. that flagged up that we're going to have this systemic banking crisis. What did flag it up was the growth rate in debt to GDP relative to trend. And the other one was particularly interesting because it was a debt service ratio of the private sector. Now, China is flashing red on both, and the coronavirus could be the thing which just triggers the need for much, much easier money in China and puts the exchange rate under significant pressure.
If you'd like to listen to this full interview with Russell Napier, in addition to gaining access to our three podcasts and interviews that we do with investment strategists, book authors, and industry experts from around the globe, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Everyone wants to retire well. That's not as easy as it sounds. You need to make the right investment choices, decide when to take Social Security, plan for taxes on your retirement income, and create a legacy for your family. To retire well, you need a roadmap to help you get there. Let Financial Sense Wealth Management help you navigate your way to retirement. We provide comprehensive, thoughtful, and personal retirement planning. Call Financial Sense Wealth Management now at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Start your journey to retiring well today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, if you're an investor, you're probably breathing a sigh of relief. After a steep fall off in stock prices last week, stock prices are back to where they were. Joining us on the program from Oppenheimer & Company is Ari Wald. Ari, let's begin with your market outlook. Last week, there were a lot of worries. The market was overvalued. The coronavirus was going to bring an end to world trade, all kinds of worries. But here we are a week later in the opposite direction.
The point we continue to stress is that it's a bull market that's being supported by very broad-based global breadth. When you think about it, large caps remain resilient. Small caps are just starting to break higher. Growth and value stocks are both rising. You have Europe and Japan attempting to break through 20-year resistance. And emerging markets are reversing to the upside as well. So we see this as a characteristic of a trend that should continue. And we expect this uptrend to remain powerful through 2020. There will be these pullbacks. We saw a 3.5% pullback in January. But even on that pullback, it wasn't damaging. It was really just a moderate check back to the index's 50-day average. Looking at a little bit longer term, we see upside in the S&P 500 towards 3,600. Now, this is based on the median gain in the second year of a bull cycle, December 2018, that low being the reference point for us.
Speaking of this, let's take a look at the market itself. You're saying this is a broad breadth. As I look at the S&P sectors, you've got consumer staples doing well. You've got consumer discretionary. About the only thing that doesn't look good is energy, which is interesting because the price of energy, when it got up to 60, the stocks weren't really following along. So the stocks are lagging the commodity. What is that telling you?
It's telling me that that's a sector I don't want to be in. It's a sector we've been recommending underweight exposure to for over a year now. And I think that's so telling, Jim, that the stocks have just not been rewarded when the price of oil rises to the same degree the sector's really been slammed when oil falls. We joke around that energy is low volatility on the way up and high beta on the way down. And what it's produced is this very established downtrend versus the S&P 500. So until that relative trend starts to stabilize, I want to stay away. I don't want to be the first one into this sector. I don't like to time lows. I'm going to let somebody much smarter than me try to bottom tick that group because we see a sector really across the board, whether it's the large integrated big cap names, the oil service names, drillers, really across the board, it's broad-based weakness. And for that reason, we maintain our underweight position.
Now, when you see these market corrections, Ari, sometimes you get sector rotations. I mean, I'm just looking at last year, it was kind of the safety trade plus tech. And then that changed in September when the Fed kind of launched its QE. All sectors began to participate. You think, or you're looking at some of your favorites are basically technology and financial. Let's talk about that.
Sure. Rotations, of course, are a function of a healthy advance, and that's what we're seeing. And our expectation is for technology and financials to take turns leading the market higher. Now, first off, it's really been interest rates that have been a key driver of these rotations. And I think given the recent downtick rates more recently, they're oversold. I think it's made the financial sector tactically attractive. I think we could be at a point where interest rates start to move higher and financials could outperform. With that backdrop, I think the risk would probably be in more of the high dividend bond proxy sectors like a REITs or a consumer staples. While technology, through these ongoing fluctuations in interest rates, has really shown quite the resilience that we're impressed about. It's not necessarily the best performer when rates go up, but it holds up well when rates go down. And it's really been a very broad-based move throughout the sector, large caps, mid, small, across industries, software, semiconductors, hardware. And for all those reasons, I think technology remains a core position. And to finish off our third favorite sector, or to round off our top three, would be the industrial sector. It's really not being represented at the cap weighted level. There has been some weakness in large cap stocks within industrials that is masking weakness in the mid cap part of the sector. It's actually a sector that's been stronger in equal weighted terms. And now that the ISM manufacturing PMI is starting to tick higher, we think industrials as well is positioned to outperform as the market turns towards more cyclical areas of the market.
You know, as we look at this market's advance, especially since President Trump came into office, we had a real strong 2017, but there's been various pullbacks in worries, whether it's the trade war, whether it was Fed raising interest rates in 2018, and now the coronavirus. But despite all of that, here we are, Ari, on this Thursday, looking at stock prices that are back to record levels.
Yeah, and through that, and we've had these pullbacks, and some of them have been meaningful in our work, that one of our differentiated views is that as much as we've been in the same economic cycle since 2009, it's now, I believe, the longest economic expansion since the U.S. Civil War, we've had equity market resets along the way. And we think in terms of the four-year cycle in the S&P 500, typically you'll get a three-year bull market and a one-year bear market. And how we classify our market bottoms, one of our best one-rule definitions, is when the index falls to an 18-month low, when it retraces 18 months of prior performance. That's a lot of time for investors not to make money. And we've had two of those resets, both in 2016, that February 2016 low marked an important low for us. And then again, December 2018 marked an important low for us. So how we see it more recently, 2018 was a bear market. It was very apparent in overseas equities, in high beta stocks, many of which peaked in January of the year, really had an established decline into that December 2018 low, a year-long decline, have spent much of 2019 base building, and now a lot of these are just starting to break higher. That's how we get to this view that we're really only in the second year of this bull market. And if you look back historically, you'll typically get about an 11% gain in the second year of a bull market. That's how we get to 3,600 on the S&P 500. And given the action in some of these market indexes with small caps just starting to break above this key level at 1,600, this could actually be the point where participation is just starting to broaden.
You know, we're also in the fourth year in the middle of a presidential election cycle, and presidents of either party always want to get elected. The thing that strikes me, Ari, is the thing that have really brought about bear markets in the past, Fed tightening, high oil prices, spikes, inflation, bubbles. It doesn't appear that any of those are a threat to the market at this point.
It really is tough, and to play devil's advocate, what are we missing? Where is the divergence occurring? You know, where could be wrong? What could be the cautionary sign that's taking place in the market. And it's really tough to pinpoint that. High yield credit spreads were maintained. There's really no stress in the high yield market. You're right. We haven't had that spike in oil that has historically led recessions. Typically, there's a boom ahead of the bust. We never really had that bust. And through that, we have these various tailwinds looking both in the equity market. As I said, we think the equity cycle is higher after that reset in 2018. And you brought up the presidential cycle, which is a tailwind as well, that historically election years have been positive for the stock market ahead of what could be more moderate gains from the post-election year, which would be 2021. So we are on the lookout for a potential market top in 2021. I think the two key points are that, one, we're not there yet, and two, even if we do get that long-awaited recession, you know, of course, we did have an inversion in the yield curve just last August for the first time through this expansion. Typically, that inversion will lead the top in the market by about 18 to 24 months, again, pointing to 2021. But if you look back at how recessions unfold in secular bull markets, what do they look like in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 80s and 90s? They're more run-of-the-mill than, say, the big collapses we had in 2001 and 2008. I don't think that's the type of risk investors should be thinking about. 1990, the most recent example of a recession in a secular bull market, which did hurt when we were in it, but it still only took the market back 20% rather than the 40, 50% haircuts investors think about as we just got through two big ones in 01 and 08. So just some more bigger picture thoughts. Again, I don't see that risk just yet. And even when we do get to that point, I think it's going to be more run of the mill than many investors believe.
So as you look at this market right now, we just had a correction. We're coming right back up to where we were. What would you be doing as an investor? Would you be focusing more on sector rotation, diversification, hold a broad group of stocks like an index fund? As an investor, what would you tell them?
Diversity makes a lot of sense for us right here, because as participation broadens here, I think there could be different areas of the market taking turns leading the way higher. Now, for us, U.S. large cap growth is a core theme. Every time the market pulls back, that's where our emphasis and conviction goes to first. But I think at the same time, we are seeing some better action in some of these previously underperforming areas that I think can be looked at selectively as well, whether it's overseas, whether it's value, whether it's small caps as well. So with that said, sector bets to play that make a lot of sense. I think it's about having a balance of both technology and financials. I guess those would be kind of two of the biggest sectors within the growth and value components. Here we're endorsing both of them. So diversity makes sense to us with a preference for more cyclical issues. The industrials is a sector as well. I think this is still, we are in an intact bull market, and I want to be exposed to those stocks that I think are going to outperform against that backdrop.
So when you see something like this, and it seems like throughout this bull market, especially over the last, I would say probably 3 or 4 years, one of the strongest sectors that has been consistent through all of this has been technology. Would that be your number one pick?
It has been our number one pick, and it remains our number one pick. For a number of years, we've been making the case that we are in a secular bull market to be led higher by the technology sector. There's a few things that lead us to believe that this strength should continue. First and foremost, how broad-based it is, as well as the large cap components of the sector have done, the Apples and Microsofts of the world. It's been much broader than that. You have a lot of mid-cap SaaS companies that are working. Semiconductors are working. Like I said, it's across capitalizations, it's across industries, and that's the type of strength that should that we think should continue to take the sector higher. The second point to note is that it's been resilient to these key sector drivers of these rotations. For the most part, interest rates, commodity prices have been big drivers of those rotations. We think those markets are going to be range bound and directionless. We think they're going to continue to oscillate. You're going to have periods where rates are moving higher, commodities are moving higher, and then they're going to give it back. And I think those value areas are in turn are really just trades for us, while tech has shown it can be all-weather leadership through those oscillations. Another reason why we like it. And the third reason, the gains are steadier than many investors believe. This, we haven't seen the type of late 1990s parabolic move there that would get us concerned to think that this is an overheated bubble. There have been checkbacks along the way. There should continue to be checkbacks along the way. And as long as that occurs, we think this leadership in technology is intact and should continue.
All right. Well, listen, Ari, great information. So if I was to sum this up, you expect higher prices somewhere around 3,600. Your favorite sectors are tech, financials, and maybe followed by industrials.
That is correct, Jim.
All right. If our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so?
Well, Jim, they can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Ari Wald, where they can get in touch with their local Oppenheimer representative.
Ari, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
You as well, Jim. Take care. Always a pleasure.
Between 2012 and 2017, over a five-year period, 7,000 U.S. banking branches closed down and 425,000 jobs were lost in the financial industry. There's a number of reasons for that, but a big reason is fintech and the growing evolution of financial technology that is allowing for a lot of automation, a lot of efficiencies that are simply removing the need for a number of people that work in the financial industry. At the cutting edge of the fintech revolution is a person by the name of Lex Sokolin. He's a futurist entrepreneur working on the next generation of financial services at a company called Consensus, which is a blockchain technology company building the infrastructure, applications, and practices that enable a decentralized world. Lex joined us on the show this week to discuss how to think about the future of finance. Here's a clip of what he had to tell listeners.
The core enabler of you being able to have an electric car or an electric phone or an electric flying drone that functions for this large amount of time is the battery that stores the charge. And over the last decade, the price of energy stored in that battery has fallen 85%. It was impossible to tell at the time. It was not a reasonable investment to say, we're really going to focus on the lifetime that these batteries can last and building capacity and creating more production, because you did not know which industries they would power. You know, if I in 2008 said, I want to put $200 million into a project that's going to maybe be the infrastructure for self-driving electric cars in 2025, I would sound like an insane person. And that is exactly where we are with blockchain-based finance. A lot of people that talk about it sound like insane people, but the type of enablement that they do can open up completely new creative spaces for financial services and have massive implications for the type of lives a lot of people live.
So if you aren't already a subscriber to FS Insider and would like to listen to this full interview in addition to all of our weekday interviews airing 3 days every week, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
One commodity that is doing well this year is the price of gold. What's driving gold? It's been up for almost 2 years in a row now. It's standing out of the pack when it comes to commodities. Joining me on the program is Greg Orrell from the OCM Gold Fund. Greg, let's get to several things that you feel that are the big drivers of gold. And I want to go through your gold thesis. What's driving this? Is it the dollar? Is it central bank demand? Is it greater demand coming from consumers? What's behind this drive?
Well, the drive, Jim, is first off driven by central banks are certainly had change of attitude towards gold. I mean, you know, we've seen Russia, China, Turkey, Iran all be buyers of gold. We've seen record demand from central banks. We've also seen a pickup of investor demand. ETFs right now are at record levels in terms of their gold holdings, higher than they were in 2011. Now, what that tells me is that we've had some big buyers. It's not the public, and especially here in the U.S. We've seen buying in Germany, demand for gold coins in Germany, where they were actually lined up around the block here at the end of the year. But what we are seeing is demand that is coming from investors globally and macro thinkers that believe that longer term the Fed is in a bind, that they have been pushed into a position of having to make sure that financial asset prices are maintained, which is long term going to be bullish for gold prices.
And Greg, is central banks change towards their attitude towards accumulating gold? Is that because there really isn't another alternative to holding dollars? I know the euro, when it came out, it was very strong at the beginning. It was supposed to be this alternative, but Europe is in a big mess. So is gold proving itself to be, once again, the ultimate currency?
It is the ultimate currency, and it has proven to be. You know, what I find of interest is, you know, the statements that have come out from a couple of the European central banks, most notably the Dutch Central Bank, who came out on their website and called that gold was basically the ultimate store of value, and especially in times of systemic risks, that the value comes back to gold, and that if you had a financial crisis, that gold would act as the basis to basically start over again. And so that, you know, I find those comments interesting because what we've seen is in the past is this hostility towards gold by central banks. And you know, whether it is a discernible shift in sentiment towards the U.S. or they see that they're into a bind and that they will have to do some type of reset down the road, but you know, there definitely is a discernible shift in sentiment towards gold right now.
I want to talk about something that can also be a driver, and that is modern monetary theory, because I think our deficit is close to $24 trillion now, and the Fed doesn't have the ammunition it had in past cycles if we get into a recession. So they're talking about fiscal policy and maybe the Fed monetizing that. And Greg, it's both parties are behind this theory, and that seems to me that would be a big driver of gold, or you could actually create inflation through government spending with the Fed monetizing it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Jim. I mean, that's part of the long-term thesis on gold as to why, you know, investors would want to have an allocation towards gold is that, you know, the debasement of currency is out there for everyone to see because you have unfunded liabilities. You have, if you have a recession, or if asset prices were to go down, financial asset prices to go down, you know, the Fed, they don't know if they have the tools to fight it, that you would have to actually go in and, like you said, you'd have to monetize everything and spending. And there seems to be on both sides of the aisle, well, that's fine. We can just print it. And that's fine until the market says it's not. What'll happen is that the gold market will come in and tell you that it's not okay.
You know, one thing else that really strikes me about this is most people are unaware, if you're in the U.S., that gold has been hitting records in other currencies like the yen or the euro. Why do you think it is? Is it because of our equities market, our economy, that U.S. investors are less inclined to invest in gold, where it's more common in places like Asia and Europe? You talk about gold, it's part of a lot of people's portfolio. Here, people tend to go into cash, bonds, or equities.
There's been historically the war on gold for a long time in the U.S., you know, wanting people to hold dollars and put their assets into financial assets versus gold. And that was even one of the things that we saw, you know, when gold started to peak this last time around. It, you know, when it came off of, you know, 1900, there was great fear that all this capital flow was going into gold and they wanted it to go into financial assets. And you know, the fact that gold is higher in just about every other currency except for the Swiss franc and U.S. dollars, you know, also speaks to the fact that, you know, gold historically is the reciprocal of consumer confidence in the U.S. And when right now, I mean, we've seen consumer confidence at levels that we haven't seen since, you know, it was, I believe, April of 1969, September of 2000, and it peaked back in August of last year. You know, the 10 to 11-year period that followed that, we saw an S&P that was flat, and gold shares particularly were up 300 to 400%, and gold itself also had multiple. So significantly outperforming financial assets. It's a cyclical nature. People feel like they don't need it right now with the equity prices where they are. And so it stands to reason. What I'm really curious about to see is what happens when the market gets tested, the market structure gets tested. You know, what we've seen is all this passive investing, ETFs, it is yet to be tested. And, you know, what will happen to the level of confidence in financial assets at that time? You know, what we do know is that gold has a history of teaching new generations about its monetary attributes. And those who knew better, you know, they've basically, the cycle is at the point now where they've died off. So, you know, we're going to see, in my opinion, you know, that greater appreciation for gold's monetary attributes coming once again.
You know, the thing that you mentioned, the financial structure, a couple of things that we observe on our end is this large concentration of index funds and ETF funds, which are driving valuations. That's why we have these trillion-dollar companies like Google, Apple, Amazon today. But also, if you take a look at the corporate structure, the corporate debt market, nearly 50% of that debt market is BBB-rated bonds, only one notch above junk bond status. And we know that funds that are only investment grade can only own investment grade bonds. So if we get into a downturn, let's say BBB bonds are downgraded, or there's a rush out of the market, and all of a sudden all these index funds have to sell at the same time, since it's concentrated in the hands of, let's say, five major players, how that plays out and how does gold perform under those circumstances?
Well, in those circumstances, what we'd like to believe is that we're going to see capital flows into the gold market at that time. And, you know, depending on what level of liquidity crisis you get will depend on, you know, if gold has a negative reaction for the first week or two, or it's going to start to attract capital right off the bat. But one thing that'll be clear is that in order to maintain financial asset values, not set off a cascading sequence of defaults, that monetary authorities are going to have to come in and be very aggressive with their policy again. And that'll be bullish for gold. I mean, one of the things that people talk about, whether it's the coronavirus or Iran, it all comes down to, does it impact monetary policy and the debasement of currency going forward? And does it increase debt levels? You know, one of the things that you have to think about with gold, what's the highest correlation since Nixon closed the gold window? And that is, total federal debt outstanding to gold, which is 90%, is that correlation. And so, what I see going forward is increased levels of debt. Unfunded liabilities need to be paid for. If you have a recession, you're going to have fiscal policies that addresses that. So if you have a shift in politics in the U.S. in terms of if the democratic socialism does take a foothold, and I see that is at some point taking place, then that is also going to lead to higher deficits going forward. And that's, that is what, as an investor, you need to look at as part of, your gold thesis for owning gold in a portfolio, is where do you see the levels of debt on the federal level, and can the U.S. afford it?
I want to talk about, you run a gold fund, so let's talk about gold equities. In the last gold bull market, you saw a lot of bad decisions, dilutions made by the big guys. Even if you take a look at those companies today, maybe they're running leaner and meaner, but they're not finding or replacing their reserves. I mean, how does Newmont or Barrick replace the amount of ounces they produce each year? Seems like to me the only way they do that is go mining on Wall Street. I mean, how do you find, and many of these companies are not replacing their reserves. So as a manager, what do you look for?
Well, I mean, that's a good point, Jim. I mean, one of the things that I have espoused to the managements of these companies is don't wait until a project is fully de-risked before you buy it. Buy it earlier on. Have some confidence in your ability to take a project up the value curve and put that value to your own shareholders versus paying another company's shareholders for that value. So replacing 5 million ounces a year like a Barrick or a Newmont has to do, those are big mines. I think that absolutely you're going to have to see companies continue to look to be acquisitive, and that was, you know, we'll see that going forward for the big guys. Now, the intermediates and the juniors, yeah, there are smaller deposits out there that can be brought on, but there aren't that many. I mean, that's part of making sure that when you're constructing a portfolio is that you have the companies and the management that have a deposit or have shown that they can develop projects and buy other projects that can be accretive. And you know, I do believe that this industry, after having gone through a number of periods where they've diluted shareholders, as I like to say, they diluted shareholders and debased their shareholders faster than the central banks were debasing currency. And that ended up leaving a sour taste in a lot of investors' mouths. But at this time, I think we are seeing investors starting to really understand that the management are looking at the industry a bit different, showing some discipline on capital allocation, understanding that shareholders, if they're going to attract the generalists, they need to run these businesses in a different manner than just as an option on the gold price.
So given where we are right now and given where the markets are right now, what would you recommend investors do? Should they mix up their portfolio with bullion, whether it's ETF on it directly, or maybe, for example, invest in a gold fund like yourself?
Bullion is a different animal than owning the miners. You know, the bullion, you're not going to have any management risk or geopolitical risk. You know, I always tell people, start off with a foundation of owning bullion. Then add in a fund like ours. Most individual investors are not that adept to the industry, and owning just one or two miners historically has not delivered the best return. And so, in my opinion, the best return is done by having a portfolio that includes the majors, the intermediates, the juniors, and a couple of sprinklings of some explorers. And that's what our portfolio does. So I tend to believe that have some bullion and have some miners with a little added leverage is the way to go about it.
And you'd recommend, which I would recommend as well, either an ETF or a gold fund where you're diversified in a portfolio, because there's, let's face it, there's risk to mining. Greg, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about your fund, one of the top performing funds in the gold industry, according to Morningstar, how could they do so?
Well, they can visit our website at OCMGoldFund.com. They can also give us a call here at 800-779-4681.
Okay, Greg. Well, listen, thanks so much for coming on the program. Appreciate the advice and counsel.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate coming on.
Have any feedback about Financial Sense NewsHour? If so, leave us a voicemail with your thoughts at 1-833-ASK-FSN.
What's your retirement goal? When it comes to retirement, you've probably heard it's all about achieving your number. At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe retirement is all about you. You are not a number. You can achieve your retirement dreams and goals. Let us help you create a consistent source of income, make the best choices on Social Security and Medicare benefits, and build your legacy for the future. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Let's work together and make your dreams come true. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
On today's edition of Smart Macro, we're going to look at the fundamental analysis and research that drives our decision-making here at Financial Sense Wealth Management with Chris Poplava, our Chief Investment Officer. Chris, let's start off with the major theme that we discussed, not just 2 weeks ago, but for most of this year and a bit of last, was the expected pickup in global growth and how we were specifically investing around weak U.S. dollar plays. Have there been any changes to that outlook or the fundamental backdrop that you discussed previously with us? And let's talk about whether or not the coronavirus has impacted this at all.
Two of the really big drivers of this thought process is looking at global monetary policy and fiscal policy. And regarding that, which really drives business cycles and a lot of economic growth, there's been absolutely no change. If anything, we saw late last month where Powell downgraded the statement regarding consumers and the odds of a rate cut increased at some point by the end of the year. So, you know, still dovish support from the Fed. They're still saying that they're going to maintain their purchases, at least I believe they said through April. So from a U.S. perspective, we still have support from our monetary authorities. And when we look at globally, we have the same. You know, if you look at the rest of the world, there's still a lot of support coming from China. And it's one of the interesting things that the head of Morgan Stanley is pointing out, that if you look at the amount of stimulus coming from China, essentially their deficit relative to GDP, there was a huge spike in 2016 in response to that downturn. And in 2015 and then subsequently 2017-18, that deficit was reduced. But if you look at last year, 2019, there was a huge spike in the deficit, not as big as 2016, but still fairly large. But the projected forecast for this year is, again, a pretty large budget deficit. So this would be the first back-to-back large deficits that we've seen with China that are north of, I would say, roughly 7% of GDP. So, you know, China is still putting their foot on the pedal to support growth. We have the U.S. Fed, which was a major issue for global markets with raising interest rates and shrinking their balance sheet. Now they're supportive. There's no change there. So from that perspective, I would say the fiscal monetary backdrop, there hasn't been any change. And if anything, the coronavirus outbreak would likely lead the authorities, both fiscal and monetary, to remain easy more than they would have otherwise.
You know, it's interesting, as you're mentioning China, we just spoke with Russell Napier. He's the well-known investment strategist and financial historian, keeper of the Library of Mistakes. He was saying how if you look at the Bank for International Settlements data that they've compiled, looking across global economies, China is flashing red when it comes to a systemic banking crisis, not tomorrow, not next week, but at some time potentially over the next 3 years. And he talked about the growth rate of their debt to GDP levels, and then also when you look at corporate debt as well. What were your thoughts on anything that Russell had to say in that interview?
I thought it was a great interview. You know, the thing I love about Russell and others is having a historical perspective. So it really is important to kind of study the past to, you know, look for those similarities that can help guide you with your future decisions. And, you know, regarding China, you know, one of the things he was talking about is that debt growth is growing faster than what the normal trend is, and that eventually you're going to see too much leverage and things collapse. And we certainly saw that in the U.S. I mean, look at what happened with our mortgage market in housing, where there was just way too much debt. And we had a massive deflationary episode where people walked away from their homes. So if you look at the amount of mortgage debt on consumer balance sheets, it dramatically fell as people essentially defaulted and walked away. And then that was a loss on the balance sheet of the banks. And the banks eventually had to be bailed out. But if you look at what Ben Bernanke did, the former Fed chairman, he essentially navigated a beautiful deleveraging, which is a description that Ray Dalio uses looking at major deleveragings. It could be a beautiful deleveraging, which is not too hot, not too cold. If you think of the Great Depression, that was a cold or a bad deleveraging where the monetary authority stepped in too late. And if you have a too hot episode, that would be like the German Weimar Republic, where you have hyperinflation. And if you look at the Fed's balance sheet, it essentially almost grew one for one with the reduction in the balance sheet of consumers. And so, you know, we didn't have runaway deflation and we didn't have runaway inflation. So essentially, the Fed was kind of going one and one with replacing what was being destroyed through default. And I think China could do something similar. I do think that's a crisis and watch point. But, you know, the beauty of China is they can do whatever they want immediately. If you look at the U.S., the Fed was, you know, a lot of people were saying in 2008, overstepping their bounds and authority. But at the time, you're in the middle of a crisis, you know, let's figure out the laws later. Let's just make sure we still have a functioning financial market. And tying into the coronavirus, you know, there's a lot of people commenting on what China is doing that has never been seen before. We have quarantine of cities, millions and millions of people. China can do things that would never be able to happen in the U.S., that, you know, that wouldn't happen in Europe. And I think China could, you know, take a similar approach, a very aggressive approach with their financial markets. So if they do have a debt implosion, you know, with a, you know, blink of an eye, China could, you know, essentially replace that one for one with new debt, government debt. So I do think it's a definite crisis point to watch, but I think it would be interesting to see how China would respond to that.
In regards to the coronavirus, Matthew Bay at Stratfor told us this week that, you know, they're expecting in the first quarter that China could see a loss of about a 1%, maybe 1.5%. So that could take them from around that 6% growth rate that they've been at for quite a while now, down to as low as 4.5%. And then a slight increase in the second quarter, depending on how well they're able to contain the outbreak to other cities. Of course, as you mentioned, I think there's like 50 million people that are estimated to be in quarantine, on lockdown, over a dozen cities. So this is unprecedented in the scale. Of course, I think everyone now knows at this point that they were a little bit late in their reaction and weren't reporting some of the details of it as quickly as they should have. So that being said, they're still making some major steps right now. And one of the things that's being discussed at this point is if China were to release these people to go back to work, then that risks the spread of it again to more of the populace. So it's kind of this delicate balance that they're really playing of trying to figure out when do they start allowing people to go back to their jobs so that the economy doesn't get crushed. And then at the same time, not also on the flip side, risk getting more people infected. So, man, it's just, it's a really interesting situation. Any thoughts from any of the research that you're looking at or some of the indicators that you're watching in terms of impacts and what this means for the global economy in 2020?
I really like the research from Morgan Stanley. I think they do phenomenal work. And one of the analysts that I follow is Chetan Iyer. He's the head of Global Macro. And based on his estimates, he feels that the impact by the coronavirus to global growth, I didn't see an estimate for China, but for global growth, maybe 15 to 30 basis points in the first quarter will be lower year over year than otherwise without the coronavirus. But he still thinks that we're going to get back on track in the second quarter, and this should not derail the global recovery. And that's something I'm seeing from other strategists, that essentially this is a hiccup, but should not derail the improvement that we're seeing with all the stimulus that is there. For example, if you look at the M2 money supply growth in the U.S., we're at the highest level we've seen probably since late 2016, early 2017. Europe is at the high level in terms of their money supply growth rate over the last decade. And even China is showing some stabilization in their money supply growth rate. Their M2 growth rate was decelerating for, you know, ever since 2015, but that's beginning to stabilize, and it looks like it might be trying to turn upwards. So there's still plenty of liquidity in the global financial system to help cushion the impact of any blow. But a lot of the change, if you look at the other viruses like the SARS outbreak and some others, is that once the weather starts to heat up, you tend to see the number of cases really die off. So, you know, we're getting ready to go into March, you know, a month from now. And we could see the level of cases begin to die off. So I think the hit is mostly going to be in Q1, but I think we're going to be dealing with the coronavirus in the second and third quarters.
You know, we've had a number of different risks or black swan events like this that have come up during this bull market cycle. And I guess the nice thing is that there are indicators that you can track to see how much of an impact will this have on markets and the economy. And that's, like you just mentioned, money supply growth rates, leading economic indicators, and the credit markets. Do you mind walking us through some of these different things that you have on your dashboard when it comes to risk management, making sure, you know, when clients call in and say, hey, I'm really scared, this is a big problem, this could cause a systemic crisis or whatever it is. Yeah, I mean, there's been so many different events that have happened. What it is that you look at to gauge, is this something that warrants pulling money out now or weathering the storm or buying the dip?
We're always doing research trying to get a handle and come up with new tools to help filter out the noise. And that's what I worked on last year, was developing essentially a model that only gives you, you know, essentially risk signals, not every few months, you know, but, you know, maybe every few years or even maybe once a decade. And that kind of helps guide my view of how risky should I be? Should I be on the defensive side, neutral, or aggressive? And these five signals that we've developed, all of them are on a buy signal. You know, we have a couple of fundamental, a couple of technical and credit type indicators, and all five of them are on buy signals. So that would argue for a more of an aggressive stance versus a neutral stance, where you might have two or three that are on sell signals. And so, you know, that kind of guides the mentality that there's a lot of liquidity moving in the system that should keep things supported. And when you look at even, you know, leading economic indicators, those do a pretty good job of forecasting where future growth is going to be. And we've developed some of our own, which we call long leading indicators that kind of lead the regular leading indicators. And one that we use is based on interest rates and some momentum measures. And that does a pretty good job of leading the conference board's LEI. And ours was arguing for a peak in U.S. growth back in 2018 in the fall. It's exactly what happened, where we saw the conference board's U.S. LEI peak in late fall, and it was decelerating throughout the remainder of 2018 and through 2019. But our indicator is now looking for a gradual upturn or bottoming process in the first quarter, and then more of an acceleration in the second, third quarter for U.S. economic growth. So we think U.S. growth will be on an upturn. The whole rest of the world is already on an upturn. And one of the things that we look at, as I was mentioning, money supply, also looking at the amount of stimulus coming from China, given it's the world's growth engine, all of those tend to lead the Global Manufacturing Purchasing Managers Index, and that all of that pointed towards an inflection in the third to fourth quarter of last year. And they still point towards an upward movement and trend in global growth. The amount of stimulus has not been pulled back. You know, the growth rate is still improving there. So all these, you know, leading economic relationships tell us that we should maintain that view of an improvement in global growth versus a deceleration, which we were largely dealing with all throughout 2018 and most of 2019.
Chris, last time when we had you on, we talked again about the anti-dollar plays that you have been allocating clients into, gold being one of them, a number of emerging markets, even some select areas of commodities. I think one of the big things that we've seen now is that there has been some underperformance in commodities. They were doing well, but that slipped in the recent month. So I guess the question is, how do you know, given that thesis of, you know, we're seeing an upturn in global growth, you expect U.S. to start growing in the second, third quarter, and the U.S. dollar to continue weaken, that's your thesis, and you have the investment strategy behind it. What is it that you're looking at just to assess if that trade is not going to play out?
I look at a whole host of data, and essentially what I'm looking for is a weight of the evidence type of approach. So we can look at economic data, we can look at financial market data. I essentially try as best as I can to come in with an unbiased opinion in terms of, all right, put my thoughts aside, my thesis aside, look at all the data. What is the data suggesting? What would be the thesis coming out of the data versus looking, have your own thesis and forcing that upon the data? And so I look at, as I mentioned, economic indicators, look at, you know, overall economic data, but I also look at the financial markets. And what I mean by that, I'm looking at currencies, interest rates, credit spreads to get an understanding of where we're at. And, you know, there are some watch points that do have me a little bit nervous if we do see some, you know, deterioration further. And, you know, focusing on the dollar, which has been, you know, one of my themes is that the global growth upturn began last year. Well, I think the U.S. will be delayed. And that's why I've been bearish on the dollar and thinking that we'd see a weak dollar relative to other currencies. And so when I look at the Bloomberg Dollar Index, you know, it does give several of the world's major currencies. But one of the things that I've created that really helps me to understand movements in currencies is I have a table looking at the dollar relative to, I'd say, about 30 world currencies. And I'm looking at, are these currencies above short-term, intermediate-term, or long-term moving averages relative to the dollar to understand, you know, how robust is this weak dollar movement or strong dollar movement. And about a couple months ago, especially, you know, in the fourth quarter, I was seeing universal strength compared to the dollar, where almost every currency was above short-term, even intermediate-term moving averages, and we're starting to see some long-term moving averages turn up. Over the last month, though, I've seen some reversal of that. Over, you know, if I'm looking at a 10-day or a 200 or 20-day or even a 50-day moving average, I'm seeing that these currency pairs, a lot of them are below those those moving averages. So that would mean that the short and intermediate trend is negative and even some weakness in the long term. So this does give me some concern that we might see a broad movement higher in the dollar. We haven't seen it yet, but seeing that breadth of strength in the dollar compared to world currencies does give me pause.
Two other places I think would probably be important to touch upon are commodities and interest rates, since both of these subjects you brought up in our last interview. What is it that you're seeing there currently?
Well, I'm seeing in interest rates and commodities very similar to what we saw in currencies, was that we saw a definitive bottom in the fall of last year. So not only were currencies improving, but we also saw global interest rates begin to bottom, and they've been on an upward path all the way entering into this year. However, in the last month, we have seen some weakness in interest rates, not just in the US, but also in Europe and Japan. If we see further weakness here and even go below the late 2019 lows in interest rates, that again would be arguing that this whole thesis of an upturn in global growth would be in jeopardy. It's not just interest rates. We also saw, in general, commodities show some strength late last year that was indicative of a global bottom. If you look at iron ore prices, if you look at copper prices, all of these began to move in the latter quarter of last year, but copper took a huge hit over the last month. I think it had 12 straight down days, something we hadn't seen in a long, long time. So, you know, copper right now, it's essentially testing its 2019 lows, which were about where it was for lows for 2018 and 17. If we go below this level, we could see a 10 to 20% further drop in copper prices, which would really question the idea of a global upturn. And looking at iron ore prices, those, if they don't stabilize here, we could see a dramatic fall of up to 30% in iron ore prices. There's a lot of things at inflection points. Currencies are at key levels, commodities and interest rates are all the key levels that if we see some further weakness in these, that would lead to probably a strong dollar. And so we're going to have to reevaluate our thesis of overweighting international, overweighting commodities and EM, and go back more towards a dollar and defensive focus.
It's really interesting. There was an article that was just out yesterday I was reading from China where they were talking about how the coronavirus is clearly putting into question how well global supply chains will be able to reshift around the coronavirus, since so much of China's manufacturing sector is now being impacted by the quarantine. Wuhan is the center of China, and it's the major transportation hub, industrial hub of a large part of China. So are companies going to be able to shift around this with the resources they need, the manufacturing that they need? Because of course, China is such a major exporter. A good portion of that is now shut down. So it's going to be really fascinating to see how these things play out. And of course, we're going to be tracking this on the show in subsequent podcasts. And I know with you as well, Chris. So with that said, would you mind telling our audience how they can get a hold of you to discuss anything that we mentioned today, or how they can find out more about Financial Sense Wealth Management Services?
They can email me at chris.paplava@financialsense.com, or they can give me a call at 888-486-3939.
Chris, it was a pleasure speaking with you on today's edition of Smart Macro. We look forward to speaking with you in a couple weeks. Don't forget to tell a friend about Financial Sense NewsHour or to follow us on social media, whether that's Facebook, LinkedIn, or Twitter. Lastly, Financial Sense NewsHour can be listened to through our website on financialsense.com. Or you can find our podcasts on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher Radio, and wherever it is that you listen to podcasts. On behalf of Financial Sense Wealth Management, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.